The views expressed on this program are not necessarily those of KUCI, its management, the California Board of Regents, or Dr. Suhaila Siddiq, or Dr. Jill Biden. Good morning. I'm your host, Claudia Shamba, welcoming you to the December 15th, 2020 edition of Ask a Leader. Today, Dr. Mahtab Jafari, UCI Professor of Pharmaceutical Sciences and Director of the UCI Center for Health Span Sciences, will talk about her now well-established course, Promoting Healthy Lifestyle Choices and Students' Well-Being, is now going University of California system-wide. Then in the second segment, Orange County Citizens Climate Lobby activists Ginger Osborne and Mark Tabbert will post us on where their bipartisan efforts over these last 12 years bring them at this juncture with a new president and the 117th congressional session. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the show. My first guest is Dr. Mahtab Jafari, UCI Professor of Pharmacology, with her breakthrough course, Promoting Healthy Lifestyle Choices and Students' Well-Being, now going UC system-wide. With remote learning expanding with each pandemic, this may be well beyond just the UC system. Dr. Jafari is a Professor of Pharmaceutical Sciences and the Director of the newly launched UCI Center for Health Span Sciences at UCI. She is also a certified health and wellness coach and dedicated to inspiring her students to create a work-life balance and achieve their health goals. The focus of her research has been on slowing the aging process and adding healthy years to human life through a science that she introduced as health span pharmacology. Using various models, such as fruit flies, she's elevated the impact of botanical extracts and dietary supplements on aging. Dr. Jafari graduated from Lycée Misena and registered at the College of Pharmacy at the Châtenay University in Paris, and then completed her doctorate in pharmacy and a residency at the University of California, San Francisco. She was on the faculty at UCSF School of Pharmacy prior to joining the faculty at UCI. She's also held clinical positions such as director of the cholesterol clinic and the co-director of the cardiovascular risk reduction program at UCI Medical Center. When she left in 2001 academia to join Abbott Laboratories as a senior scientist in the neuroscience group and eventually became a regional medical science manager, she though understood how much the teaching setting was something she really did appreciate. So she did return to UCI. She was recruited back so she could develop a new major in pharmaceutical sciences and help develop this new department of pharmaceutical science, which is now becoming a school. She's racked up a multitude of teaching and mentoring awards from within and well beyond the ivory tower. I won't list them now in the interest of time, but it's stellar. The main topic of today's interview with Dr. Jafari is her course that she developed 8 years ago, Life 101, with the goal of teaching and inspiring students to manage their stress and adopt healthier lifestyle choices. It surely is a perfect role for an academic who combines authority with humility. It's a rare combination. She comes to us today safely from her office in Irvine. Welcome back, because she was one of my first guests when I started the show in 2010. Welcome back to Ask a Leader, Dr. Mahtab Jafari.
Wow, thank you, Claudia, for your introduction. And I cannot believe it's been 10 years already. Wow, 2010.
And whoa, it's what a ride it's been, because just like you, my guests have taught me so much and my listeners are leaning so closely to what you all have to say to us. So just as a beginning, we are getting better acquainted, you and I, beyond UCI. And I would like to take the liberty of referring to you by your first name, if I may.
Oh, yes, please. That would be great. Yes.
Okay, thank you. So would you first talk about the need you saw and how you brought students into the process of building this course, Life 101.
So the need that I felt was the need for a course to teach our students how to manage their stress and adopt, you know, healthier lifestyle choices, as you mentioned. And that was back in 2013. And the class really started by office hour with a student of mine who came to my office and was very stressed out. And I talk about her in the TEDx talk that I gave in 2013. So I'm not going to repeat that story.
But we can refer people to that talk. That's very important.
So after the very first time that I offered Life 101 at UCI, TEDx UCI invited me to share my experience with that course on the TEDx stage. So I gave a brief presentation talking about how I developed Life 101 and what have been some of the impacts that this course has had on my students. And at the time, I gave this talk after only teaching it once, I believe. And pretty much—
Oh, really?
Yes, it was. I think it was only once, maybe two times, maybe once in winter quarter and once during the summer session. But what I, you know, told the audience was that I interacted with a very stressed out student in my office who had a pretty good GPA, but she walked to my office and started crying, thinking that she's not going to be able to go to medical school. And throughout the conversation, the conversation shifted from academics to other things. The fact that, you know, she was gaining weight and she was very upset and depressed. And she practically sat in my office and cried. And I just kept giving her tissues to, you know, just, it was a very heartbreaking experience for me to watch her cry like that. So I started talking to my other students, the students in my lab, and also the students who I interacted with, and I realized that we did have a stress epidemic on our campus. And then I learned that we had a stress epidemic actually on all college campuses, and it was not unique to UCI. I started reviewing the literature, looking at the survey data that, for instance, UCLA and other universities and public agencies have been collecting about the mental status of our students. And this was back in 2013. So I developed a course, I offer it, and I guess the rest is history. And so for the past 7 years, I have offered this course during winter quarter, during the regular academic calendar, and also during the summer. And I have anywhere from 300 to 400 students every time I offer this course. And I feel very privileged that this winter, starting winter 2021, this course will be offered and available to all UC campuses. So UCI will be offering the course. We are the main campus offering the course, but any student on any UC campus can register and take this course.
And this is simultaneously, it's you are the one that's leading the course?
So for the first, I would say for the first 7 years that I offered the course, I pretty much offered every single topic in the class, from stress management to nutrition, exercise, you know, mindfulness, personal finances. But this past summer, last year in winter 2020, I retaped all my lectures because I received an ILTI grant, an Innovation Learning Teaching Initiative grant from the UC Office of President. And I was able with those funds to retape all the lectures and also enhance the course. So in winter 2020, I had guest speakers for two full lectures and two half lectures. One of them was Dr. James Hicks, and he presented a fantastic talk on exercise, the importance of exercise for mental and physical health. And the other speaker was Dr. Ruth Benka, who is the chair of psychiatry at UCI. And she did an amazing job, a really good presentation on the importance of sleep for health. And then I had two other guest speakers who helped me with the nature therapy. Miss Ariel Tuito gave a very interesting presentation on nature therapy. And then I had Mr. Giovanni DuRosso, who talked about bad habits and how we can change them. So really the course has been evolved, if I can say that. And the evolution of the course is always based on the students' feedback and what they tell me. So with the grant that I received from UCOP, I was able to work with DTEI at UCI and with two amazing instructional designers who helped me really revamp the course and make it look like exactly how it looks like today. So really enhancing the course and the version that will be offered, that was offered during the summer and will be, you know, offered again in winter, was a teamwork between me and Bo Choke, who was one of the instructional designers, Daphne Zhu, and also I cannot help Natalie, who was the videographer who helped me with taping all the videos during winter quarter.
And in a very informal setting, when we were talking about this course a while back, and you were talking about the contribution of your students in addressing needs and putting that into your curriculum. Can you talk a little bit about that? Maybe examples of what, like some stories about that?
Sure. So back in 2012, when I started thinking about developing the course, two of my undergrad students, Beatrice Chiang and Stephen Kurumadu, were two of my undergrad students who were working in my lab as student researchers. They really helped me to develop the very first list of topics for this course. And to give you an example, it was Stephen who suggested to include personal finances in the course. And I said, wait a minute, this course is about, you know, stress management, lifestyle, you know, choices. And he said, believe me, Dr. Jafari, you know, money and finances is a big source of stress for students. And he was absolutely right, because again, I reviewed the data, I looked at a number of surveys, and that was personal finances are in the, you know, top three when it comes to stressors. They also taught me how different cultures perceive mental health differently. For instance, they told me that in the Asian community and Asian students, even admitting that you may have any type of, you know, mental health issues such as, you know, depression or anxiety, it is considered a stigma. So it's either a stigma that is a self-stigma or it's a stigma that their family or the communities put on the students. So they really taught me that don't expect to come and give a talk about stress management and how to manage your anxiety and expect that the students would share their issues with their families or go see a counselor. So for me, that was an eye-opener, and that was the beginning of me really digging into self-stigma when it comes to various cultures and ethnicities.
Well, that is really interesting, because I was thinking in preparation that I'm thinking of your own background, originally from Iran, you were educated in Paris, France, that you had an idea about some of the blind spots in our American dominant culture, but those are the students that were bringing that to sharper relief for you in your building this course.
Yes, absolutely. And they taught me so much more than, you know, what I just said. For instance, I mean, just to give you another example.
Please, yes.
I learned from my students that the first line coping tool for students when it comes to mental health is their friend. So if they feel depressed, if they are low, they won't really go and see a counselor. Their first line therapy or treatment is their friend. And this is what taught me the value of education. And this is why in Life 101, under the resources that I have for the students, I have a number of websites. I have linked to practically any wellness initiative or any wellness resource that we have at UCI for our students, including the, you know, mental health center. So, and I encourage them to do that. And I have learned that I need to acknowledge the fact that they talk to their friends first, but then I tell them that this is another resource. And I also talk about the signs and symptoms of depression and how they can prevent suicide in a friend. So I tell them that I'm not trying to say that you're suicidal, but I'm trying to kind of teach you how you can detect those symptoms. Because again, imagine that we have a student who has suicidal thoughts and they're talking to a friend. So if that friend is knowledgeable about the signs and symptoms, they can definitely be of more help.
So it doesn't surprise me that this front line is where they're going first. If that the accessibility of that friend and sort of the immediacy of running it by, because you sort of want, it's like you're the first kind of lifesaver to throw at, to reach for is that person that's right there. Like with so many different kinds of campaigns of, in any construct, they always say, go to where you are. And that friend is where that person is that is ailing. So that makes a whole lot of sense. And I'm sure once that was brought to your attention, you could see the kind of elegant logic to why that was a first step in getting help.
Yes, absolutely.
So I'm trying to remember when the article was breaking in mainstream media about the incoming freshmen. They were talking mainly about the UC system, I think. That wasn't national, but it was statewide. That there were so many incoming the first year students that were arriving with huge coping inadequacies. And I thought, well, it shouldn't surprise any of us when I'm looking at my peers and I'm looking at how sort of overbearing parental approaches and styles, that overbearing, or they call it hovering helicopter parents, if that they're involved in the upbringing of these students, that I'm wondering two things. Is it a surprise they start college life so ill-equipped? And do you feel like, Mahtab, that would it be nice if the kind of coping Life 101 is doing, is there's some kind of intervention earlier in a student's life?
This is a very good point, Claudia. And I am going to repeat what students have shared with me in their feedback, in the emails that they have sent me, and also in the teaching evaluations for the course. Mm-hmm. I tell you that practically all the students who have taken this course, they have told me that they wish they had taken this course as a freshman. So these are the students who have taken the course as a junior or senior student at UCI. I would say unanimously, they say that they wish they had taken the course as a freshman. And then many of them believe that every student in college should take it. And, we are talking about Life 101 because obviously this is a course that I'm teaching, but right. I would say any Life 101-like courses should be offered on college campuses to teach our students some very basic lifestyles and life skills, and also help them to pay attention to their mental and physical health. We keep talking about self-care, but self-care doesn't happen automatically. Self-care is something that we have to learn. And what I have learned from my students and in this class is that when you present evidence, when you present scientific facts about the harmful effect of stress and how you can recognize it and how you can manage it, I think students pay more attention than if I only come and share, let's say, a few stories about my years in high school and college and just tell them, so now go work on your stress. For instance, in the nutrition class, we talk about the harmful effects of sugar. And that's pretty much all I talk about. But I present data. I talk about how sugar can be harmful acutely and chronically. And then we talk about all the hidden sugar in our food, in the food that we consume on a daily basis. So I make it very simple, but very practical. But you're absolutely right. I have noticed that too, that many of our students are not really ready to adopt the college, life. And we see that because we have a high rate of binge drinkers, for instance. We've had issues with alcohol and drug use on college campuses, and we still do. I don't know the data during the pandemic, but I have been reading some.
We'll get some. Well, the data's coming.
The data
I'm
is
sure coming. We're all going to cringe when we find that data.
Exactly. Just imagine a student who had all these restrictions at home to drink. All of a sudden, the student is in a dorm with a bunch of friends and they can drink as much as they want. But if you present data to them, which is something I do in Life 101, we have a topic that is called bad drugs on college campuses. And the first bad drug that I talk about is alcohol. And I tell them in the beginning of lecture that I'm going to talk about things that probably make me a very unpopular professor, but I'm okay with that because I'm here to tell you the truth and nothing but the truth. So we talk about, you know, how alcohol can impact them and how we are all different. Our genetic makeup is different. You know, the normal dose for me could be, I don't know, one or two glasses of wine. I don't know that because I'm not really a drinker, but for somebody else, it could be even less than that. So I think education is, knowledge is power.
Oh, so much. So for those of you who've just joined us, my guest on Ask a Leader is Dr. Mahtab Jafari, UCI Professor of Pharmaceutical Sciences, Professor of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology, and the Director of the UCI Center for Health Span Sciences, with her breakthrough and now well-institutionalized course, Promoting Healthy Lifestyles and Students' Well-Being, now going UC system-wide, Life 101. So I guess as March 2020 saw a consequential, a rather monumental shift in how everyone was going to do business, what did you see would be necessary to adapt your course, Mahtab, including now you're going to be coming up for this winter course? It's going to be an exponential increase in the need and probably so many enrolling. How are you going to handle all that? What are the changes you're making?
So when the shelter in place order was placed in March 2020, all the classroom teaching was moved online. Everything was remote, was moved to remote teaching. At the time, I was at the very end of my classes in winter quarter, which were molecular pharmacology and Life 101. What I did with my courses, and I was also teaching lab courses. I was teaching two lab research courses, BioSci 199 and PharmSci 199, and I had about 10 students in those courses. Wow. So I moved my 170 students in molecular pharmacology to an online class and 300 students in Life 101 to the online, and also the lab students. And it was a lot of work. I'm not going to deny that moving everything online was quite difficult. For Life 101, it was not that much work because I had already offered the course online. Mm-hmm. And all I did was I had to just come up with an idea to make sure that the students finish the course and, you know, get credit for it. So that was not very difficult. Molecular pharmacology was a different story because students were supposed to take their last exam. I don't give final exams in my courses. I have exams, and usually I have anywhere from 3 to 4 exams, and this was the last one. So what I decided to do is to really like consider the living situation of my students, because, and also the fact that they were under a lot of stress. A few of my students who moved back to their homes told me that the living condition was not ideal. I give you the example of one student who told me that they moved back and he had to share a bedroom and a living room with 3 other siblings. So now imagine that you're taking online courses and there are 4 of you. I think 2 of his siblings were high school students and another one a college student. So 4 of them taking online courses in a 1-bedroom apartment with 2 parents. So that was quite challenging. And many of our students also, they lost their part-time jobs that were supporting them to pay for the gas and, you know, their car or their food. And that created another level of stress for them. So, I mean, no doubt that everybody was under a lot of stress, but students were under, I would say, I don't want to say more stress, but a lot of stress.
It was, though. It was more.
Because they were taking
absolutely. So is there going to be like a pandemic tab to the, like a portion that will just directly deal with how things change, how to deal with the sort of public health threats of different interpretations and appreciations of the pandemic threats. I mean, is that going to be a part?
You know, I don't know the answer to this question. Of course, we have to be very mindful of the fact that we are in a pandemic when we teach. What I did, for instance, with molecular pharmacology was that my exams are open notes, so students can refer to their notes when they take the exams because they are not based on factoids. My exams don't test memories. They test, you know, understanding and conceptual understanding.
Yes.
But what I did was that, so my final exam was online, but what I did was I gave my students 2 days to complete it. I didn't time them because I knew that the 2 hours that I was going to, for instance, assign students to take the exam, I was thinking about the student who sent me an email and said, I'm in a one-bedroom house with two parents and three siblings. There are six of us in this house. So I was thinking about him when I designed the hour of my exam. And I said, you have 2 days. You have 2 days to complete this exam. And I hope that this helped them to alleviate a bit of the stress that they had. And with my research courses, I just continued teaching writing online. And I remember this was the funniest thing. I thought that I was doing such a great job. You know, I'm teaching a writing course online. And then in the middle of the spring quarter, so this is like spring quarter. Now we are in spring quarter. We are done with the finals. And I offered my teaching research courses online. Two of my students dropped out of the course and they sent me an email and they said, Dr. Jafari, this course is so stressful. It's too much. Mm-hmm. And I really, really appreciated how honest and candid they were about sharing this with me. So I completely changed the format of that course. I completely changed it. I didn't have all these assignments on a weekly basis. We try to have more discussions. I gave them more time for the writing assignments. And I was very thankful for the two students who were so stressed that they had to drop the course, but at least they sent me an email.
Well, that seems like a marker, a measure of how maybe they were previously enrolled in a Life 101 course and they were dealing with an issue. They were tackling it head on. They weren't waiting for, or they weren't deferring on it. They were recognizing it, addressing it, and resolving that. I mean, so that's the life skill that you're so...
Oh, yeah, I'm laughing because this is precisely what one of them told me. I won't mention her name here, but her first initial is... I share the initials. Is VG, and she's a pharmacy student at UCSF now. And she told me that you taught us in Life 101 that we have to like get rid of stressors in our lives. And Dr. Jafari, this course is really giving me a lot of stress. So... I said, yeah, that's very fair. I get that.
The measure of that. Well, so I'm going to put you on the spot, though, because you're one person with some help inside your pharmaceutical and maybe ecology, evolutionary biology, and a few others are helping. But I'd like to know, how are other departments, other schools at UCI, supporting what you're advancing for the students' sound mind and body? Matab.
So I have been getting support. I talked about the grant from UC Office of President.
Yes.
And Ms. Ellen Osmundson was the person that I worked with in that office. And she was, her help was tremendous in finalizing and getting that grant. And I have worked with both Daphne and Natalie at DTI at UCI. So I have been receiving support to develop the course. But this course has so enthusiastically received by students, and so many students have signed up that we have exceeded the class size. And right now I'm at a point that I like to offer it to more UC students and UCI students, but I'm having challenges with limited TA support. So I'm really hoping that moving forward, hopefully next week, I will have more TA support. And my department is helping, and we are hiring another TA for the course, because right now I have 430 students in this course. And we capped the course at 400. And I'm really hoping that with the support of my department, I can increase the class size so that I won't turn away any students. So I am getting support, but the course really exponentially grew, and we are using the same metrics that we often use for TA assignments. And as you know, our resources are limited, funds are limited for support to hire TAs. But I like to think that this course is a little bit different. And this is a course that can really impact a large number of students during these difficult times.
Well, isn't there a tidy sum of money that is available in the Illuminations program? There may be, I mean, if they want to think expansively in that program, that might be another possibility. And when you said 400, are you talking about over the whole UC system, or is it just 400 anteaters?
So right now I have 400 anteaters, to be exact, 395 last time. I check the number every morning.
Refresh.
No panics or anything, but we are at 395. And then with the XC students, these are the non-UC students. I don't have the numbers. As of last week, I believe we had 35. The course is finally advertised and they have to go through an approval process through their home school. So I am sure that I'm going to have more students. So hopefully we can accommodate all of them. This is my goal. And I'm pretty sure that we will be increasing the class size to accommodate all the students. And you mentioned Illuminations.
Yes.
That is a very good idea. I'm going to link Illuminations to UCI Illuminations to Life 101, because 2 weeks before we closed campus, it was actually in March of 2020, I hosted and moderated an Illumination event. And it was a mini film festival by Octus Productions that Illuminations invited to come to UCI. And I invited the students in Life 101 to attend this event as a stress release, you know, exercise. And they came up with all excuses. Oh, we have a final the next day. Oh, we are very busy. This is 2 hours. This is too long. But the students who came, and there were many of them in the audience, they all told me that being away from their studies for 2 hours to just watch movies and relax and have fun really helped them with their stress. So I collaborated on that project with my good friend, Julia Lupton, Dr. Lupton. I think I'm going to send her an email tomorrow morning and tell her what you told me. So thank you so much.
Please. And whether Jane Page, who looks expansively at what theater can do to bring a contemporary point, a topical, a very essential kind of development. I would think between you and Daphne Lay and Jane Page, I think there is, you're ready to, you've got something to go on. Well, I know we're drawing.
I'm taking notes. Thank you so much for these recommendations.
So we've run out of time. I'm going to have a continuation of this interview on a separate link of a podcast. So thank you so much.
It was really a pleasure talking to you.
My guest was Dr. Mahtab Jafari, professor of Pharmaceutical Sciences College of Health Sciences and director of the UCI Center for Healthspan Sciences at the College of Health Sciences. We'll be right back with Orange County Citizens Climate Lobby activists Ginger Osborne and Mark Tabbert with new opportunities to push the needle on support of the carbon tax. Welcome back to Ask a Leader. My next guests are Orange County Citizens Climate Lobby activists Ginger Osborne and Mark Tabbert. Ginger, a longtime environmental activist, has worked to protect Laguna Canyon, to establish state marine preserves, and has assumed leadership roles in Village Laguna and the South Laguna Civic Association. Now, as a retired psychology professor, Ginger Osborne devotes her time to addressing climate change through Citizens Climate Lobby, currently serving as the CCL chapter co-leader in Laguna Beach and surrounding communities. Mark Tabbert has been on maybe a dozen times on Ask a Leader. He's a national level board member of Citizens Climate Lobby. Both will talk today about the juncture Citizens Climate Lobby and its House Resolution 763 is at with the winding down of this congressional session and bringing in a new presidential administration. Lobby Week is this week for them, following their rousing activist national conference last week. Ginger comes to us from her home in Laguna Beach and Mark Tabbert from his home in Newport Beach. Welcome to Ask a Leader, Ginger Osborne, and welcome back, Mark Tabbert.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So let's talk about where does the citizen climate lobby, carbon pricing, tax fee dividend stand with endorsements? Broadly speaking now, we'll get to cover this, folks, in larger detail in a later episode of Digging Out, but we're going to go quickly through the leadership's endorsements in the business, state and local leaders, the legislative leaders, and activists sectors.
In terms of business, Claudia, I would talk about the economist that published a letter in the Wall Street Journal. This was last January. It was signed by 55 economists, 27 who were Nobel laureates, and they came out in support of carbon pricing. And they had six parts, six Roman numerals in their letter. And each of those six Roman numerals is in the bill in Congress, H.R. 763. We just got three new sponsors this week, so we're up to 85 sponsors. So in that letter, after 55 members signed it, there have been 3,500 more economists across the country. And if you go to just about any college in the country, whether it's Harvard or Fullerton College, you're going to find economic professors in there who have signed on to that letter supporting carbon pricing. In terms of business, you could cite people like Elon Musk has supported carbon pricing now for a number of years. Senator Mitt Romney has expressed interest in supporting carbon pricing, thinks it's an idea that we need to examine. The U.S. Conference of Mayors, which is all the mayors in the country get together once a year. And at the last conference, they came out with a statement that they support carbon pricing as found in 763. They didn't endorse the bill, but they described it in the same way that 763 does.
What I would add is that in addition to the mayors, the city councils have, at this point, 123 city councils who have endorsed carbon pricing.
That's nationwide, Ginger?
Yes, nationwide.
There's a few more cities we got to get. Okay.
But we are wanting to show how local governments want to have a carbon price. And so we are encouraging them to endorse carbon pricing, or more specifically, the Energy Innovation and Carbon Dividend Act. And so in the last year or two in Orange County, we've had the city councils of Costa Mesa, Laguna Beach, Santa Ana, and Brea endorse carbon pricing.
And in view of the election, I think you're going to have Irvine. I'm very much am sure that's going to flip.
Yes, and going to begin to talk with Aliso Viejo.
And Huntington Beach has some new members that are pretty positive towards our effort to get a resolution there.
Okay.
And we continue to work with faith communities. And so we have 20 prominent faith organizations at the national level who call for Congress to pass carbon pricing legislation.
And Ginger, let people know these are not local churches. This is the Presbyterian Church, the United Church of Christ. So we're talking large faith organizations have been backing this bill now, some of them for as long as 2 years. There's another group worth mentioning, which is 70 large health organizations, including groups like the American Medical Association, the American Heart, Physicians for Social Responsibility, to name a few. These are all major groups. The truth is, if somebody studies what we can do about climate change without a political bias, they almost invariably come up with the same idea. Put a price on pollution so that the oil, coal, and gas companies pay, and then return that money to people to protect the poor and middle class from rising fuel prices as we become a cleaner, more prosperous energy environment than we do now.
And part of the role of Citizens Climate Lobby is to educate those that are speaking about it, that are supporting it, that they have full literacy that it's a rising carbon price. It's not fixed. That's part of the lift you've got to take, right, with your right. Spokespeople.
And so it begins at a moderate level, $15 per metric ton. And and each year increases by $10. And so that people can adjust, business can adjust to it to make changes in how they're going to make their investments and presumably direct it toward R&D for non-fossil energy sources. So it's something that is helpful for the economy because businesses want to be able to predict what's going to happen in the future. And so having a gradually escalating price on carbon gives them that predictability.
And one thing that was very interesting about the conference conducted with Citizens Climate Lobby was the contributor Hari Han. She was talking about business, though, they really need a little bit more of a push from some kind of governmental leader to bring them over the line with endorsing this policy.
Well, you know, there are a number of businesses that have endorsed carbon pricing. There's about 30 large companies that have endorsed it, including, well, the Silicon Valley Leadership Group actually endorses carbon pricing in principle. They haven't been specific about the bill, but they like the principle of putting a price on carbon at the well, the mine, the port, and returning the money to people. And that includes not only Silicon Valley giants like Microsoft and Netflix and everybody else, it also includes people like Coca-Cola. For some reason, they're in that group. And other groups of Procter & Gamble are in that group. But it's true what you say. We need leadership everywhere we can, including people listening to this show today, Claudia. I think you mentioned a quote that was in that conference this weekend, is that presidents need to be pushed to act.
Another point that Hari Han brought up was the refrain that we hear a lot now is that Franklin Delano Roosevelt said, make me do this. He wanted to move on relief in the Great Depression with his New Deal. And the LBJ, with respect to advancing civil rights legislation, use the same FDR line, make me do this. So that's where CCL is at the point where you're trying to leverage national leadership, making them do this carbon dividend step.
Well, we make them do it, quote, make them through many levels, from the grassroots to the government leaders. So we are working by educating. And I was gratified when I listened recently to Bill Gates in The Big Questions. He said, if you want to do something about climate change, the most important thing you can do is raise your political voice. And so that's what we want everyone to do, is to raise their political voice and say, we need action now. And so the time seems ripe for action, as we have a president-elect who has a carbon price as part of his program. And we have a situation where, with a possibly divided Congress, and even if Georgia elect Democratic senators, it'll still be by a small margin. We need to have a bipartisan plan. And the carbon fee and dividend plan that we're talking about, the Energy Innovation and Carbon Dividend Act, which is the particular one that we are supporting, is one that has bipartisan support. And it has that bipartisan support because Democrats generally want to have the poor people protected. And in fact, this does more than just the very poorest of our society. The dividend that comes from the revenue of the carbon tax is distributed equally to people. And the lower 60% of individuals will come out even or even better when their increasing fuel and other carbon costs are included.
So the disincentive using carbon in industry has direct impacts on their communities.
Absolutely. And we all benefit. As the less carbon is used, the air becomes cleaner. when people think about a bill, they don't think about what costs are going to be removed from the bill. And so in terms of the health benefits, there are going to be fewer premature deaths, less direct health costs, and fewer days lost. And it's been estimated that that amounts to $700 billion a year. So that's what we would save by reducing carbon in the air.
So Danny Richter, the lobbyist for Citizens Climate Lobby, also had a very sizable platform with the conference this last week. And he talked about how uniquely positioned Citizens Climate Lobby is with its bipartisan portfolio to move through this lame duck session and on into the next brand new congressional session. Talk about what's the strategy right now for the remaining time with the lame duck session, and I'll ask more about the congressional caucus reconfiguration after you answer that.
Citizens Climate Lobby has been working for 13 years for carbon pricing. And the way we've done that is to work with both parties. So we have a reputation in Washington that really nobody else has. We're the group that talks to Republicans and Democrats both, asking the same thing, treating everybody with respect, appreciation, and gratitude for their public service. So we're right now sort of in the catbird seat. I don't know where that expression comes from, but we're in a great position to be somebody at the table when they start talking climate policy. Actually, the bill that's in Congress right now that we're referring to, 763.
Right.
It virtually is exactly what we asked for the last 12 years.
This resolution have to be resubmitted, though, under a new number, but it's going to have the same title, essentially the same text, Mark?
We don't know what the title will be. They might change it. They might keep it the same. We've given our thoughts in that regard. We're set up by chapters. Normally, a chapter covers one congressional district, but Ginger and I happen to have two chapters in CA 48, Harley Ruta's old district, and now at Michelle Steele's. I guess the two points are this. We're known for carbon pricing throughout Congress on both sides of the aisle. And very few people now wouldn't acknowledge that. The problem is we've got good relationships with Congress, but we need to get this word out to the American people. In my dream at night is that I wish Biden would have a fireside chat with the American public and explain carbon pricing. Because if he did, you know, use whiteboards like Katie Porter does such a good job at in Irvine, and Ronald Reagan did the same kind of stuff. If he would explain what carbon pricing is to people so that they understood what in the hell they're talking about, then there would become a lot more pressure from the public at large to get Congress to move. Right now, there's a lot of pressure on Republicans to do something about climate change. Kevin McCarthy's talked about it. Mitch McConnell has even talked about it, surprisingly to many. They know that Republicans under 40 poll at the same percentages as do Democrats. So Republican Party, and that was done by a Republican pollster. I can't think of his name right now, but quite a famous guy.
Luntz Global was the polling group.
So, Ginger, did Luntz poll both Democrats and Republicans?
He surveyed all Americans.
Okay.
And he found that overall, two-thirds support a fee on carbon, and with the revenue being returned to households as a regular dividend check, and that there was support across all parties, including the majority of Republicans, and three-quarters of young Republicans for such a bill. And so there is bipartisan support. And this is a time when there are a number of proposals for taking climate action. And we have had regulations as a mainstay of trying to limit carbon emissions. But those are not popular with Republicans. And because they are experienced as onerous to business. And so further regulations on carbon don't have much of a possibility to move in a relatively divided Congress. So we need to have a solution that has bipartisan appeal. And
there's another thing to mention, Ginger, that we don't, not to interrupt you, If you do regulations in the United States, it doesn't change what happens in China and India. But part of our bill, part of the bill, 763 in the House, has a border adjustment so that importers and exporters that don't have a carbon price like we do pay an import duty when they ship products to our country. And we give a rebate to people that ship to countries that don't have a carbon price in their country. And if we have exporters we're dealing with is in the United States. So this is really a global plan. This is the United Nations Paris Agreement with teeth, because it has American muscle, economic muscle behind it.
And again, why this is so important is that in two more years, in January of 2023, European Union is going to enact their own border carbon adjustment, and that it's going to put American manufacturers at a disadvantage because if we don't have a comparable carbon tax, so that it behooves us to get on top of this, get a carbon tax in place that would be equivalent to what is in Europe, and so that goods can flow without tariffs. And it doesn't put our manufacturers at a disadvantage. And with both the European Union and the United States, with a carbon tax and a border adjustment fee, that it will encourage other countries to tax their carbon similarly, because they don't want to pay that money for the tax to us, but rather to use it in their own country for ways that they decide. So that border adjustment tax is a way of influencing other countries to move in the same direction.
Let me just introduce my guests. They are Orange County Citizens Climate Lobby activists Ginger Osborne and Mark Tabard here on Ask a Leader. So there's a couple of things I want to flag here as we're drawing down in our time together. Is one thing that fireside's not going to work. You're not going to want fuel burning behind Joe Biden when he's making the pitch. The other is the fee is what you talked about when you're talking about the U.S. Senate disposition about carbon dividends. So, and the fee was the term used in the Luntz survey. So the semantics are always important. I know Citizens Climate Lobby always is contending with whether to call it the tax, a fee, a dividend. So that's just something to tag. And then John Kerry, maybe something that he used when he signed the Paris Accords on climate change. He made the point of putting, I think it was a grandchild of his own, seated in his lap. So if President-elect Joe Biden positions another generation or more in his midst to appeal to the broadest possible public, because the public's polarization, I don't have to unpackage that at all, but to sort of make it an intergenerational appeal, which would trump the sort of partisan tendencies that could be a reaction to that appeal, make that appeal resonate more deeply and naturally. So those are my last points that I'd like you to respond to before we have to close this lovely interview and open up in much broader detail in a future, near future, Digging Out episode.
You know, Claudia, I wanted to mention something we didn't touch on before when you asked about supporters. Our number one supporter for this is the IPCC, which voiced their support in October of 2018.
The International Panel on Climate Change, just for anybody who's not into the...
Right. Yes. And also, I mentioned that AOC has come out and mentioned carbon pricing three times, all positively. And I'm not sure that the left has heard that support from her. It's not part of the New Green Deal, but it's words to the effect that we need to put a price on carbon, just like we're saying in these bills. All 12 bills in Congress right now that price carbon.
Claudia, I would respond to what you were saying. That image of Kerry with his granddaughter is very moving. And I'm reminded of how Republicans, too, are concerned about their children. And that Bob Inglis, when a representative from North Carolina was...
And I've had him on this show. My listeners know him. He's been on twice. Yeah.
And I was very moved by his story where he was running for re-election and...
In South Carolina,
and asked for help from his son. And he said, I'll help you, but you have to drop your climate denial. And Bob Inglis thought about it and not only dropped that, but became a real advocate for climate action. So thinking of the younger generation is something that certainly motivates me. I have grandkids. We were up in the Bay Area where they live in 2018. The fires from 200 miles away sent smoke and ash to their area in Berkeley that so darkened the sky and polluted the air that we could not go out for 5 days. And I realized that that is the environment that they are going to be living with, not just that year, but it's happened, of course, this year and will in the future. So that very much motivates me. I think it'll motivate other people to think of the younger generation and say, we need to act now.
Well, I want to thank both of you for participating in what was a real quick round here of that. I just want to wrap up the interview with your addressing where the Congressional Caucus, that what your immediate steps are going to be in. We know Harley Ruta drops out of it. He was replaced by Michelle Steele. Everybody that was in the Congressional Climate Caucus has to re-enter paired with the opposite party. Quickly, what is the CCL strategy for building that back up for the next legislative session?
Well, right now we are working to get as many co-sponsors on the current legislation so that when it is reintroduced in the House, and that is the plan, early in the next Congress, that they will all re-sign and will begin the momentum to get other signers. And we're also looking toward the Senate to get a companion bill introduced.
And there is no Senate companion bill yet.
Not yet.
It's always been in the House, which is important.
In the lame duck session in 2018, there was a Senate bill.
Okay.
It was not reintroduced into this current Congress, but it shows the potential that it can be. And there are other carbon fee and dividend bills in the Senate right now. So we are hopeful that there will be a bill in the Senate.
I actually think there's a carbon pricing bill in the Senate. It's just not like ours.
Well, yes, there are. And with the president being in favor of a carbon fee, this will help to provide momentum for that action to take place.
Not only President Biden, but also John Kerry and Janet Yellen, their support is going to be really instrumental, I think, in getting this Congress to move.
Well, thank you very, very much, folks. This was a lightning round, as I said. We are going to unpackage all of these aspects of the carbon dividend, the carbon tax, the carbon fee in a later episode on Digging Out. Thank you, Ginger Osborne and Mark Tabbert, for being on Ask a Leader today.
Thanks, Claudia.
Thank you, Claudia.
Well, that was my wrap. Next week, we'll consider how much room there may be at the inn. That is, how experts envision that U.S. immigration policy will shift under new management. Talk with you next week. Thank you for listening, everyone. Okay, vaccines are coming. We're still masking up.
Light of God that shines, happy, joyous Hanukkah. Around this whole wide world tonight, happy, joyous Hanukkah.
Nine is for God's light that shines, eight for the new built altar place, seven for the sons of heaven.